The brothers Wiss. The brothers Wiss, brothers Wiss. The brothers Wiss. The brothers.
You're now listening to Greg. It's the brothers Wiss. Let's take
Hey everybody, this is Greg with another Greg Talks. This is number 14. And today we have Nick Arellano. I said that right, didn't I?
Yep, you did.
All right. Brilliant. What's the origin of Arellano?
I believe it's Spanish.
Is it?
Think so, yeah.
You bringing that Latin flavor?
Not really.
Well, bowl me over with your enthusiasm. Goodness. Well, Nick, it has been ages since I've talked to you. You've been, you're a bit nomadic. You've been all over the place lately. So let's play catch up. I think most of the folks are familiar with you, right? So you live up in, where are you living now?
Right now I'm back in rural Illinois area. Moved back from Lyle.
All right.
Moved away from the city again.
You just couldn't take it. This is the big city can't hold you. I get it. You need the big open skies.
Yeah, I would say that. Moving on to bigger, better things.
Bigger, better things. Always, man. Always moving forward. One foot in front of the other.
Yeah.
It's the only way to be. So, Nick, you're brilliant at a lot of things, but can you do a backflip? Is that something that's in your repertoire?
A backflip?
Yeah.
No. I've always wanted to do a backflip, but I was chickened out.
Well, you're useless to me then. All right. No, I don't know. I've had a lot of weird, random things on my mind lately.
Yeah.
And I've been feeling different kind of ways about different things. I was just curious what it's like for other folks right now. So I've been going through this thing where, man, like once a week, maybe once every 2 weeks, I'll just feel like so anxious. Like just, I don't know, man, just this anxiety out of nowhere. And it kind of just like hits me and I just, it's not like a panic or anything like that. It's just kind of, I don't know, man, it comes out of left field. And I was trying to like get to the origin of it. I'm not 100% sure where it's all coming from. Like so much of my life has been changing lately, but it's sort of hard to pinpoint anything, right? It's like, usually it's like what you do, you change like one variable at a time and see how things go.
Yeah.
So I just figured I would change absolutely everything at once. And so troubleshooting is kind of difficult, you know, which is so funny because like you're a network guy, I'm a network guy, although you're moving into more kind of the, what would you consider yourself, like software, DevOps? What would you say?
I like software a lot. So I'm kind of on the fence between networking, software development. So I've been kind of gravitating towards building some automation tools and stuff like that to kind of marry the two together, but haven't decided what I like better right now.
what do you think makes you enjoy software more than kind of like the networking piece?
I think, I don't know, I've been doing networking for 5 or 6 years now, and unfortunately, I think most of the scopes of the networks that I've worked on have been kind of the same exact kind of thing. Mostly heavy, like dealing with kind of smaller enterprise and smaller WISPs, and so a lot of that stuff is pretty much the same. There's a lot of like templated standards and ways of doing things, and most of the time that when I get the networks, they're pretty sloppy, like layer two problematic, and then you kind of get them to a good calm point, and you can help them kind of take over eventually, understand how everything's templated, and help them get software systems in place. And then after that handoff process, there's not much, you know, past that, and so it kind of gets repetitive and a little bit boring.
So,
it's easier to.
How do you reckon you split your time? So you're currently developing some software packages or package. I'm not sure which it is, but you're also doing consulting, right? And all kinds of things. And so how are you splitting your time? Are you doing about 50-50? Are you doing 60-40? What do you think the split is?
I think lately it's been more 80-20 programming versus networking. But a lot of the things that I'm trying to build are going to kind of help with the network side and managing networks. So it's kind of a good path there. But some of the stuff that I want to build is so complicated that I have to really kind of study and explore different ways of dealing with stuff in the software space, and it's a lot harder, and there's a lot more ways to do things in the software side, especially. That's so right. Trying to figure out what path I want to take to build an actual production level product has been difficult.
So let's reel it back a little bit. So would you say, how would you quantify your relationship with consulting right now? Or you sound like, if I had to sort of put into my own words what I'm hearing from you, it sounds like you're kind of getting bored with doing the same network rebuild over and over. Is that how you'd kind of quantify it?
Yeah, I mean, because I've been doing the same type of networking, there's some larger scale like designs and things that I'm not confident enough to do consulting for. So it kind of gravitates towards, you know, smaller networks building up from not having much in place in the first place. So I think that side of things a little bit, which is kind of driving me more to build some automation tooling and you know, ways to do maybe more of that work, but actually less hands-on, more smart, you know, tooling, I guess.
But that's kind of that's the promise of automation, right? Take the parts that you don't want to do that are repetitive and have software do them in a repeatable, efficient manner, right?
Right, right.
All right. So this actually reminds me of, I don't know, this conversation sort of back when I first met you, I think, I don't know if it was the first time I met you, but we were at the Pittsburgh, Mom? Weren't you at that one?
Yeah.
And I remember you.
No, I don't know if it was that one. Might have been Baltimore.
Oh, yeah, yeah, Baltimore. Yeah, that's what it was. Because, I remember. And we went and ate, like, Cinotto at some Italian place, and Dave was there and stuff. But I remember there, you were saying something to me. I think it was at that one. You were saying, and I'm bad, I have a horrible memory. But I seem to recall you saying, you know, I want to be a consultant. You know, I want to get into consulting. And even your LinkedIn profile, you say something like, you know, that you want to be an evangelist as far as that stuff. And I remember telling you, you know, then just do it. That's all you've got to do it. And so it's so funny to see, or for me to try and reconcile the Nick that I knew not that long ago, who was like, man, I want to do this consulting thing, but I don't feel like I know enough. And you know, it's like, but I mean, even the little I knew you were at a level that was well above some of the other consultants I know and most of the folks running networks. And so you actually had value to add to those people. But now I see how far beyond that point you've progressed in like such a short amount of time. Have you kind of looked back at that arc and looked back at that previous Nick? So Nick, like 3 years ago, like what advice would you have for him, you think? Or do you even feel like you're that different?
Well, it's weird when you're the person trying to think of yourself, you know, 3 years ago, I don't really remember how I was or what my ideals were, I guess, at that point. But I think when you live in an area where there's not a lot of IT around you and your friends aren't network people or software people,
right.
You don't really get to talk about technologies and things that you're dealing with day to day. So you don't really know where to set the line on like where you're trying to get and like where I would feel like I was adequate at something. And so because that I didn't know where to set that line, I set it so far ahead, assuming that everybody else was so far ahead and I know nothing. And I think once it gets to the point, it got to the point where I was able to network and talk to people, I realized I probably know a lot more than most people operating networks, because, you know, especially people that run businesses around networks, not a lot of those people go deep into the engineering and stuff. They're, you know, they're trying to be profitable and make money, so they're deploying networks, you know, to get money going, and they worry about the engineering later. And so it's weird when you talk to other people and you realize, like, hey, there's a lot of people operating networks that don't really know exactly what's going on, but they have customers and they need help. And so out of nowhere it kind of clicked, and I don't know, I always 100% most of the things that I'm interested in. So I don't like to cut corners, and I don't like to touch stuff unless I'm pretty sure I know where I'm supposed to be or where I'm going. So I think spending all that time diving into stuff and not realizing when to stop and relax a little bit kind of took me pretty far as far as that goes. But
yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I think if I would have talked to myself 3 years ago, I probably would have said to find a way to go network with people, meet people, talk to other people in the industry, and you know, maybe I wouldn't have suffered so long banging my head on stuff. You know, if I would have found some sort of mentorship opportunity or something, you know.
That makes a lot of sense. You know, like if you don't have a yardstick to measure yourself against, it's like you just have to kind of ballpark, and that's that's tough to do. And you made it way harder on yourself.
Right.
Is that kind of a common theme for you? You're like pretty difficult on yourself. You set very lofty goals or expectations upon yourself, maybe.
I think even what drove me into software is I'm picky with like user interfaces and how things work. And so if I want to build something or make something, I want it to be something that's like enjoyable to use, something that feels like natural. But then, you know, the more that you dig into software and network design, you realize it's actually a lot harder than it sounds, you know, to make things clean and easy to navigate. And when you do consulting and stuff and you see some of these other half-built network designs people have put in place, you learn a lot of cool things, but at the end of the day, the whole point is to, you know, give control of the network back to the person that owns the network and hopefully help them understand why things aren't working and where they should be going and like what they need to learn, rather than, you know, trying to vendor lockout. But I have a whole archive of configs I've pulled from devices that other consultants have touched, and I've learned a lot of interesting things over engineered designs, but I feel like that it causes more trouble than it's worth when people try to be overcomplicated and flashy.
Well, that's interesting. So, you're talking about over-engineered designs. Where do you, or how do you strike that balance when you're, say I'm a new network to you, right? That I've already got some stuff existing in there. They have, I guess, expectations of growth or planning on how they're going to build. But obviously, if I'm calling in a consultant, I've probably got limited experience or knowledge in whatever I'm doing. So how do you strike that line of making this thing, you know, expandable or scalable so that it can grow and do all these things they want, but also keep it simple enough to where, like you said, you can hand the keys back over to them once you've got it in kind of working condition?
Yeah, I think my biggest problem was assuming I needed to understand everything at a very deep, low level. But when in reality, I think the job of a consultant is to bring the customer somewhere in a middle ground where they kind of understand where you're at, but it doesn't need to be like the industry standard, like large scale design. Because once they have a stable network, and at least just the IP subnetting and scheming and firewall practices, as long as they understand that fundamentally, eventually they'll hit a growth point where they'll just hire engineers and they'll grow, you know, internally, but they'll still have control over the network. So I think instead of focusing on complexity and flashy configurations, I think people should focus more on repeatable, understandable implementations, especially with things like software too. I'm learning more and more about that sometimes the best software is not the flashiest written code. It's something that, you know, someone else can pick up. Because if you're doing consulting, like you probably shouldn't be under the mindset that you're going to maintain this network for the rest of your career. You're probably going to move around and take on new networks, and so you kind of want to put things in place so that it can be taken over, you know, and so they can move on. It shouldn't be something that you spend, you know, 10 years working on a customer's network. You should be taking on new work, new jobs. Same thing with software. Like, if you build clean, maintainable software, you could always hand it off and someone else can take it over. And networks last, you know, multiple generations of people, usually, like the large-scale network. So you're not really designing the network for you to be flashy. You're kind of designing it for the next set of people that are going to take it over if you move on. So I think that's not focused enough.
Yeah. And you know, the more complicated it is, the more it's going to fall on your shoulders, right? So not just from like you said, not just from a consultant's perspective, but even if they do get engineers in there and it is complicated, they're still going to be leaning on you, which means once you touch enough networks over time, you're going to have people constantly calling you. So if you ever want to have a vacation or you know, sleep soundly at night, that's going to be kind of complicated if you don't have easy, repeatable mechanisms in there that they can understand. That does, I mean, and you said repeatability and reliability, right? Like it just, you want something that pretty much just works.
Right.
Obviously.
A customer should be able to take a template and build a new tower site, and they know like the next set of subnets they're supposed to use.
Yeah.
You know how it's supposed to connect with the rest of the network. And so if you can focus on building things that way, then software automation is that much simpler because you've kind of built the template, and so you can automate stuff. And that's why, you know, most of the industry is moving towards software-defined networking and software-controlled networking, and because ultimately that's where things are going to go.
What about the troubleshooting side? I know like when you're building, expanding, doing things like that, replacing kit, that's great with templates, but what do you do when stuff goes wrong, you know, and they have to troubleshoot? It's like, how have you approached teaching these guys like how to troubleshoot? Because I've had moderate success here and there. It's usually like if I go in there and I do stuff, I try and take notes, or I'll make videos of the after action of all the things I did. And, you know, I've seen some customers actually take that and grow and share it. And some are just like, okay, whatever. And I'll just call you again the next time it breaks. And you know,
I think it mostly comes down to monitoring. So if you have a good clean network and you have enough of the monitoring in place, like syslog collection, and you have actual triggered alerts on stuff, I don't want to be, you know, I want to know about a problem before it happens. So the more that you can learn from a previous problem and build alerts out of it, so that if it starts to happen again or there's some warning signs like, hey, this is, something's not right, you need to fix it, I'd rather do that preemptively than after the fact. And I think it gets really bad with networks that you don't own completely, because especially once you start teaching people how stuff works and at least how to find answers for things, and they're not solid on the troubleshooting, then they're very quick to start doing things, and it makes the whole thing a lot more confusing, because then once they start changing things, it's easy to mask the initial problem. So I think as much monitoring and logging collection as you can get up front makes it a lot easier to do analysis on, like, if something happened, what was happening on the network around this time. So I think the focus for most people should be to, you know, come up with a clean templated design that makes sense for the network as it is today, and then back it up with monitoring and log collection, and you know, have somebody understand how the tools work. That's why I like NetXMS so much, because anything you can think of that you want it to Slack alert you for, you can set up alerts and metrics for. And so you just let it watch the whole network. When there is a problem, you can kind of know like where to look and how to find out what happened, especially with who logged into what device. You see if maybe a user did something, and you can track what happened and fix it quickly. But without that stuff, it's so much more difficult.
Has NetXMS really become like part of your networking workflow, I guess?
I would say so. Yeah.
Because I've taken a couple of swings at it at various points, and it is somewhat cumbersome coming from the outside. And I never dedicated. You can always find the time, so it's no excuse to say I didn't have the time. I could have found the time, but I just put those cycles towards something else.
Yeah, I mean, and with my NetXMS installation, I have a couple different networks that I manage, but all the notifications are cleanly like split up across different Slack channels and stuff. So it's pretty easy to know like when something's wrong. But it's so much nicer to deal with that than trying to do traditional troubleshooting methods and logging into all these devices and doing stuff. And so that's kind of what's driving me towards software, because I've probably got 13 or 14 VPN connections to different networks, and I would much rather have software available to do remote troubleshooting without having to switch VPN connections to remote networks. I'd rather just pop open an interface and do whatever diagnostics I need without having to jump into that network.
That's cool.
So I think there needs to be better tooling.
You know, we're kind of thinking about, we were having this conversation about, you know, at what point do you sort of start something? And I found it to be true especially here later in my life, is that sometimes you just need to start doing a thing. If you want to do a thing, sometimes maybe your first effort's not going to be the best, prettiest, cleanest, and it may not even function at the end of it, but sometimes you just got to get started on stuff. And when you're talking about like this software piece, like what was your, because it's turning into something that's going to be pretty amazing, but it's also turning into something that's going to be pretty big. So how did you kind of convince yourself to get started? Was it just, let me just do this little piece, and then it turned into, let me add this and then add this? Or what was the trajectory of
that? It's just something I want to have that I don't have. There's a couple software solutions out there that can kind of do the same thing, but it's absurdly expensive, like, you know, $15 to $20 per endpoint or something insane. And so I think that's kind of the primary factor, but I feel like even if it's not a commercial product, if it's something I used internally, that just means I can, you know, take on more consulting work and have things in a more safe, controlled environment, even if it's not something that, you know, is a public tool, at least something for me. But, you know, dealing with, you know, encryption and like tunneling protocols and stuff is quite complicated. So it's hard to get kind of just a rough proof of concept if you want something that's, remote network accessible. So yeah, I mean, it's all interesting stuff though. It's just, you have to really understand how to do it right from a security standpoint to make sure that everything end to end is safe, especially if your, you know, customer networks are depending on some management software.
Gotcha. So are you building it from the perspective of, I'm going to put this in front of people, this is going to be a client facing product? Or are you just phase one, just saying, hey, I just want this functional, even if it's a little clunky and ugly, I'm still going to use it, and that's going to get it going? It's like, kind of which mindset are you sort of moving from, or is it a hybrid?
I want it for me, and then I want to see, you know, what people might, you know, be interested in for something like that. But it's mostly for me. You know, I want a certain set of features, and I want the usability of configuration. You know, if you can template a network, then why can't you have a tool, you know, help mass deploy configuration in a way that you want with more customization without having to write scripts and stuff like that. So
that's awesome.
I think that's at the current point, that's kind of what I'm focusing on.
Got you. And I can't imagine any large scale network operator that wouldn't want that kind of functionality. So the idea of it becoming a product is very enticing. And I mean, you've been consulting in the WISP industry, right? So it's, I mean, it's really kind of focused on those sorts of networks too. But didn't you say you're like thinking about maybe having it do some cable modem plants and CMTS or whatever as well?
Yeah. So one of the things that I'm currently building is for cable modem provisioning, because it's a lot simpler. So because all that stuff is DHCP, TFTP. And like they use a time of day protocol instead of NTP. So basically it gets a DHCP lease, the DHCP options say what config file to download, and it gives it the IP address to the TFTP server. And so that's kind of some low hanging fruit in this area. But the whole concept or architecture behind it would be very similar, where there'd be, you know, a remote agent type software that connects to the cloud and, you know, can run SSH commands on the CMTS units and stuff. So there's a couple people around here that run cable plants, but they don't really know how to configure the CMTSs and stuff super well. So I want to try to automate that, template that, and kind of use it as a test bed, because it won't. And I think an actual network configuration platform, especially for like MikroTik routers and stuff, is going to be something people are definitely interested in, especially when version 7 comes out and you have like connection track syncing. It's going to be probably pretty popular with enterprise networks, because you can't get that kind of feature set with a lot of other vendors. So I think it has a huge potential, but, you know, with version 7, it looks like some CLI stuff is changing, and there's some unknown certainty about, you know, templating and automating stuff like that until that's kind of figured out. But yeah.
That's, I mean, I can definitely see a lot of, especially the large providers out there. So the large WISPs, some of the guys moving into fiber to the home, they're going to have they're going to have CPEs, right? So even though they're putting an ONT out there, they're or OLT, I can never remember which one's which. Even though they're putting a piece of equipment out there to terminate the fiber. They're usually putting in managed right. routers, and so MikroTik would be an amazing fit for that, especially if they had an interface that could make all that stuff super simple for them. It sounds like you're the prettiest bell at the ball right now. You just aren't releasing anything out yet, so I'm really anxious to see what you come up with.
I just hate all the user interfaces that are out there for a lot of software. So like if you're gonna, I've tried a couple products that you can manage equipment with, but like if you're gonna edit like a router or something, and you want to go on an interface, like there's certain things that are annoying. Like if you click on an interface and you switch to a different URL and like you lose where you were at. And so some of the things that I want to be able to do is like edit a device. If I click an interface, have like a side panel fly in while I'm still on that device's page, and I can make edits, but I also want to crawl through similar things. Like if there's a firewall policy on that interface, I want to be able to click and have another thing slide in. But ultimately, I want to be able to backtrack and stay on the device and not lose context of what I'm configuring. There's a lot of really convenience things, I think, that aren't focused on with a lot of software products that make it kind of clunky.
Sounds very nuanced, what you're trying to do. And while it sounds easy to just say it out loud, it's exceedingly right. difficult it's to actually put in code, right?
Right. I want something that feels good, you know, to work on networks with. Something that's not, I don't have to fight, like, everything's comfortable and well thought out, and so it's definitely going to be difficult, but I think there's definitely a need for stuff like that.
That's cool, man. That's cool. And like I said, I'm super excited to see what comes out of this. I can't wait to go to WISPA and stand in the booth with you and help you sell your stuff, help you peddle your wares. It's going to be, we're going to have a good time, man. It's going to be a lot of fun once we get to point.
We'll see. Got a lot of interesting stuff.
You got to manifest it, brother. Manifest it. It's going to happen. You know, unless you decide to take some, you know, $500,000 a year job from somebody at some point. I could see you going to work for Google or something like that. That would be pretty cool too. They might make you leave.
That'd be interesting.
The middle of nowhere, Illinois, though. You might have to actually move to a real
place. I'm fine
with
that. So
I thought you might be. Let's see. So this all came about from me saying that I've had some anxiety lately. So I like to pull it back around to that. You know, I was thinking about, and you know, every human is entirely a unique creature, and I'm sure Mary even has like a unique perspective on all this stuff. But I was thinking about, it's like, why have I felt like more trapped lately? Because I've been working from home for a long time. But so I used to work in the NOC with a bunch of guys, and so I got a lot of human interaction all the time, right? And then I moved off to an office by myself, but I would still walk in there and see them at least a couple times, a few times a week, you know, and we'd interact. But then by then I was playing pickleball. So I was seeing like other humans, like interacting with other humans, like personally, at least a couple times a week. And then they moved me to a new office even further away from everybody, but I was still seeing, you know, those pickleball people. And then I started working from home for like a year, year and a half. But again, I was still going out and seeing other humans. Well, now I'm still at home, but there's no other humans. And I wonder if that's contributing to my like sense of like feeling trapped like an animal in a cage. I think maybe it does, that I'm just not going and seeing other people. What's your perspective on, were you as isolated before all this stuff as you are now? Or, I mean, do you feel like,
I would say so.
All right.
I've always kind of been to myself. Like I said, like where I'm at, there's not a lot of there's not a lot of technical people. There's not a lot of like software type stuff around this area. So most of the stuff I'm interested in, other people are not. So I generally keep to myself. And some of the things that I'm learning are complicated enough that you can't just kind of wing it. And so there's enough material to go through and stuff to keep me busy, but. I say it's about the same, but I do want to be able to travel around and talk to people, and but I don't know when that's going to happen with everything going on today.
Yeah, it sounds like a year from now or so we'll be able to interface with other humanoids. I say that. We went to Austin today, so we drove 2 hours to Austin. It's like an hour and 55 minutes from my house. to get to Gus's chicken. And then on the way, we ordered the chicken. We picked it up. Well, we walked in there, we peed, we picked it up, and then got back in the car and then immediately drove home. And that's the most I've been out of the house. That was the first time I've put on pants, yeah, since April, early April. They do still fit. The butt is tighter. You're welcome, by the way. But I don't know. It just it felt good to get out and everything. Austin, it was interesting. A lot of places there, I think most of them, or if not all of them, require you to wear a mask if you're going indoors somewhere, which is a good idea. And all the folks inside, not sitting at tables. I guess you just have to wear the mask to walk in the door and then sit down, and then they take their mask off and eat or whatever, which is better than nothing. So there was still a lot of folks being safe out there. So I don't know. It's a wacky world we live in. How's your like day-to-day change? I think Mary forces you to interact with other people more than probably anybody else, right?
Yeah, but I do work from probably 8 o'clock in the morning until 7 or 8 p.m. usually, Monday through Friday, sometimes weekends.
You're just an animal.
There's just so much stuff to learn, especially on the security side and all that stuff. So been busy.
And you enjoy that too, right?
I do, but I just know it's necessary. So, you know, if you're going to do communication from a remote network to your network that manages infrastructure, you have to deal about encryption and authorization and the API. You have to be able to verify who's making the calls and if that network has access to whatever devices in the cloud platform, and like all this stuff that has to be, you know, well thought out and not messed around. I've even talked to a couple third-party companies that do like code auditing and stuff like that. Because the language that I'm writing, a lot of the complicated stuff is a new language to me. But it's something I'm taking pretty seriously, and I want to make sure, you know, before our people's networks are on it, that it's been properly vetted and everything works. So there's just so much to do that I've always kind of worked that way, though. Work all the time. But Mary makes me do other things and watch movies and stuff, so... She balances me out.
That's good, because you wouldn't take time out for yourself otherwise, right?
No, I wouldn't. It's a problem.
Yeah, it's a problem. It's a problem. You've only got so much, as Trump tells us, everybody's only got so much life force, and you can't waste it working out. You can't exercise, because that will waste your... No, yeah, I mean, you've got to break away. You know what? If I've worked on a problem and I've banged my head against it, I'll get nowhere, and then I'll go for a jog, and halfway through, I'll come up with a good solution. Or I'll wake up, which is more often, at 3 in the morning, and I'll have the perfect solution. And then when I wake up fully at 8 in the morning, it's completely gone by then. So I don't know. Sometimes just getting away from a problem helps me. Does that help you get some perspective sometimes doing that sort of stuff?
Yeah, I would say so. I think at some point, though, you know, if I have something that's usable and something that I don't have to stress so much about, and, you know, maybe it could turn into something where, you know, I could hire people and kind of shift the load around. I think right now I'm just trying to get as much done as I can in a short period of time so that, you know, I have that time later, you know, maybe have other people help or, you know, work with people on a potential product. but I think, you know, in the meantime, there's a lot of stuff to go over and a lot of stuff to kind of figure out. But eventually, I don't want to work like that all the time. Eventually, I want to relax a little bit and, you know, not have everything on my shoulders.
Right. Enjoy the fruits of your labor.
So, right.
I get it. It's the American dream. It's what everybody's shooting for. So, speaking of APIs, I've been playing with them a little bit more lately. So I've been doing the Ansible stuff, and I've been getting it to control some various things. So have you ever heard of ServiceNow?
ServiceNow? I have not.
People call it Snow as well. It's like self-service IT is what it's supposed to be. So it's kind of this web interface, and you can build up all these forms. And so I'm following a blog post. So one of my fellow Red Hatters, the guy who's actually been assigned as my mentor, really good guy, Michael, he wrote this blog post on it. And it is the most convoluted system to go. So it's like, you know, like in Tower, which is the, you know, kind of the GUI orchestration interface for Ansible, you know, the commercial version. So in Tower, generating like the token and all that stuff, super easy. I mean, it's like three clicks and you're done. So that part's, I mean, that's something Ansible has been really good about, is most of their parts are fairly easy. Some of the more complicated things can get hairy really fast when you're trying to do playbooks, you know, with like filters and then calling out to, anyway, I digress. So really easy to generate that key. And then you go into ServiceNow and it is like this convoluted set of interfaces where you move. And so I was just thinking, it's just, I don't know, it just felt ironic to me that there's this self-service IT portal that's supposed to make everybody's life easier, right? Because now it's just these forms, right, and you do a little click. And it is like, I don't know, man. It's like trying to do a standing long jump over the roof of your house to get that stuff to actually work. So it's just, it's funny how complicated it is on the back end to make it so simple on the front end for people to work with it. And I guess it's just a function of how modular they've tried to make ServiceNow. You know, they've tried to make it so insanely modular that all of the pieces are broken out into these completely separate menus. And then the way everything ties together is fairly convoluted. But this is somebody coming from the outside that's never touched this thing. So maybe once you develop a workflow inside, it makes more sense. I'm not sure. But it is like deciphering Aramaic right now for me. It is super bizarre. But I just,
have you logged into AWS before?
I have now. Yeah. Yeah. there's a lot. Yeah.
Similar thing.
Holy cow. There's so many menus in AWS.
I mean, everything's a balance. So, I think, the hardest challenge for a lot of people is, I don't know. I've looked at a lot of different code, especially in this language that I'm learning. I've done a lot of just code reading, just to see some of the design patterns and stuff that people follow. And I've noticed that most of the really solid programmers, their code is really deceptively simple. So it's like, and it's a lot harder with user interfaces, especially. So that's why usually you have a back-end team and a front-end team. So the back-end engineers, it's very easy for them to make databasey-looking apps where it's kind of like a light wrapper on top of an Excel sheet where you're just editing the stuff in the database, but then making like a really friendly user interactable like UX front-end application that kind of masks a lot of that complexity is very complicated. And so that's one of the things that I care a lot more about is the ability to use the tool. But some things like AWS, there's so many tools and there's so many features, you can't really make that very clean without sacrificing some of the flexibility. But I totally get that though, with especially with APIs and stuff. But now with security and stuff, it's a lot more complicated. And so most people are moving to like OAuth authentication, which is like a whole like three-way handshake. Instead of just giving you a token, you can slap in.
Yeah, this is using OAuth too, I think.
Yeah.
On the communication.
So with traditional like simple applications where you just generate a token, people don't. That's hard for anything that's critical, because if anyone gets that token, they basically have your credentials. And so, there's some mitigation with stuff like JWT. There's like expiration times. And so that will expire and you have to like renew it at a time interval. But especially in like web applications, any JavaScript library can grab whatever keys stored in local storage, and now they have like access to your account if they were to scoop it up. And so now there's all these newer authentication schemes coming out to try to mitigate these problems. And OAuth is the most common one now, because you have to make a request to this third party. You get like a refresh key and like an authentication key, and then you use that to like create your session key, and then it's like a whole dance you have to do with the server just to get your credentials authenticated. But it's the price you have to pay when, you know, stuff's available in the browser.
Yeah. I mean, that's the idea, right? It's, you're going from one
right.
cloud platform to another. There has to be some secure communication. Right. And that absolutely is true. Like I was just going to try and stand up a Tower instance really fast, and which, to be honest, is like one of the easiest things. Basically, you download their script, you add what passwords you want to be the default on the thing. You just tell it to run and it does all that stuff, which is awesome. And then I was like, all right, let's next step. It's like, okay, make sure that you've got a good clean certificate. And there's like, ah, crap. All right, here we go. And so I did Let's Encrypt on there. And I just kind of pulled together, bodged some stuff together from several different little guides. And it's actually, it's like very few steps on a clean tower install. So that wasn't very difficult. But yeah, it's just, you know, lots of little things you have to layer together to make it all work nice and play nice. And it's interesting, you know, just to see all of these different cogs, you know. And so you were talking about AWS. This, I am learning into so many technologies that I've never had to touch before.
Right.
Which I love because, you know, it's a love-hate relationship right now. So I'll have to do like a playbook or proof of concept on something that I've never touched, which means, all right, now I've got to go and learn about this other thing. What is this other thing? And okay, this is what it is. All right, well, how do I do a base install so I can start using it? And then so you've got to like learn a chunk of the functionality, and before you know it, a day's gone by and you haven't even started writing your playbook. You know, you're just just standing on another thing. And so some of my other guys, like Jimmy, I was talking to him, he was like, yeah, that's kind of what happens. It's like the Ansible stuff doesn't change that much, but the customer's using this other thing that you've never heard of. Now you got to go figure out how that works,
right,
to make them all tie together.
How to plug it in.
Yeah. Which I think is awesome, but it's going to help me stay relevant. Well, not even relevant. It's catching me up to like 5 years ago, because I've let a lot of that stuff just kind of fall by the wayside and I really shouldn't have. So it's kind of bringing me up to speed. Like I had to learn what Jenkins was the other day. Not that I'm interacting with it just yet, but, it was interesting to learn about more. But you know, I hear through so much of the marketing stuff that I'm going through about CI/CD, you know, this continuous integration, continuous delivery, and the Jenkins material I found actually gave like a really good base level understanding of what CI/CD is and how it operates. And so they basically said, this is how it used to work. And you know what, this is my interpretation of what they said, so it may be wrong, so you can correct me. But they basically said that people used to, I mean, if you're, I assume a large company, you have multiple programmers, and often they aren't all sitting right in the same room, right? They're distributed all over. And, you know, you probably have an international programming team if you're a large software company. And so all of these folks, what they would do is they'd work on their portions of the code, and then at night, they would all put them into a repository, and every night a new build would be produced, like a nightly build. And then the next morning they would run tests against that build and try to find any bugs. And then those bugs would go back to the original programmer that worked on that portion of the code. Then they would readjust and it would go back to the repository and it would hit the next night. And so to actually have like a release cycle of anything, it would take forever for that process to churn through over and over. And they were saying that with the new continuous integration, continuous delivery, the idea is you work on a little chunk of code. So I'm here in College Station. I work on a little chunk of code and I submit it to the continuous integration server. So I put it in the repo, and then you have pre-built tests that it runs those against. And so it checks and tries to make sure your code didn't break all these things, do all these things still work. And then it'll run it through other sets of tests. Which I think you were talking about, you can do in GitHub now. Like they've made a lot of this stuff free for some amount, but it also looks for like your formatting. You know, are you using the company standards as far as actually building your code goes? And if that all passes, then it can kind of go into kind of a staging area and then actually move into production. And there's companies like, I know this was a little bit older material, but like in 2018, Etsy would on average make 50 updates a day. And so they would run through the CI/CD and then actually roll into production every day, have 50 new iterations. And I was just like, that's crazy to think about. So you could have all these armies of ants chewing away at code, and it just goes through the process and then rolls into production. It's pretty, that's pretty bananas to think about. Is that sort of it in a tiny way?
I mean, basically, all the gist of it is it's a service or set of tools that runs before your code goes to production. It's just a safeguard. And so now with, you know, GitLab has their own thing. GitHub has their own thing, which is now has a generous free tier. There's third-party systems like Circle CI and a whole bunch of other ones that will hook into your repository accounts. And every time you do a pull request or anything, it'll double check that everything works before you merge. So usually you'll have like your master or main branch of whatever you're working on. And when someone's going to work on a feature, they'll make a new branch. There'll be a whole copy of the code base in its own branch. They can make whatever changes they want. And then when they push them, then like with GitHub Actions, for example, you have the ability to pull in Docker containers. They have a whole bunch of pre-built operating systems you can specify in the config. And so you can have your code deployed on basically a container running Linux and Windows. And maybe you want to test Ubuntu, CentOS, whatever. And it'll spin up your code, deploy it in a container in that environment, run all of your test suite. And then if it passes on all of the different operating systems you're trying to support, then everything will be green in that branch, and then you can merge it into master and you know everything's good. But if anything breaks, it'll tell you like what test broke, so that way the developer can go back in and figure out what broke, why it broke. Maybe it only broke when you run it on Windows, and so you can go to fix that, go to deploy again, everything passes, everything's properly formatted, and then you can merge it in. So I mean, there's no reason not to do that at this point anymore.
Well, you know, so Git is like, what is it, SCM, like a source code management system where you can, so you threw out a lot of terminology that I didn't learn about until I started at Red Hat. I was blissfully ignorant of all this stuff. And I think a lot of network guys just don't know anything about version control and Git and all that stuff. Yeah. So when you're talking about different branches and master and all that stuff, so. And again, this is my limited understanding because I'm still a newbie at this stuff, but it's surprisingly easy to use. And I've already seen the value and function of this stuff for more than just like programs, like programming and stuff like that. Like I can absolutely see the benefit of storing configuration stuff like in this, or storing configuration templates in this format, right? So it's you have a master branch, right? Which is like you're saying, this is my gold standard. This is the working whatever it is. So say for network guys, this is my working template. I put this on all of my tower routers, right? So this is right, obviously you're going to leave out IP addressing and stuff like that, but you can have the blanks there and you could say, okay, I want to pull a copy of that. So you can clone it, right? So you can clone that repository to your machine and you can have your own little personal branch. You can make all the changes you want, and then you make a pull request, right? Which is, I've made some changes and I want to stick those up and have you check them out. Is that kind of the gist of it?
Yeah, it's just a way for multiple people to coordinate on the same code base. And so it's just a fancy, basically a fancy file system. And so you have these things called branches, which is just like a folder of all the files that make up your code. And when you like make a new branch, it can take literally an exact snapshot of the code base and make a whole copy of it that you're free to make changes on. Delete stuff, change whatever you want without impacting the actual like master repository. And if you decide like you don't want to make those changes, you can just blow it out, but it doesn't impact at all like the primary branch that you made a copy of. So a lot of people will make a bunch of different branches for different features they're working on in an app. But also you can pull, like if something changes in the main branch, you can take your like side branches and pull those changes from master. So you can always sync back to the master so that what your copy of the application or whatever you're working on, the configuration, has the most up-to-date changes, but like also keeps your changes. It's actually quite, it can get quite complicated, but it's basically just a fancy file system that you can go forward and back in time based on what changes were made, and you can see who made the change. And then the tests tell you, hey, all this code passed the tests. It's safe to run. As long as your tests are written well and you test, you have good test coverage, you should know with confidence you can merge that code into the main project that runs on production systems without having a breaking change. And you can get as granular as you want on that, and some people have to test for multiple operating systems. Right. But you kind of set this stuff up and it just does it. Every time you do a git push, which sends it up to your source control system, it does all this stuff, and you can have it email you or Slack you and saying, hey, this broke. So you can go in and figure out what broke, try to debug. That way, like, you know, you never have to push production code out that causes your systems to go down, because it got caught by this system that, you know, you don't have to manually go through and be perfect, because nobody's perfect.
Yeah, and I like when you like save changes to your repository, you know, you make a commit, at least by default it forces you to add a comment to every commit you make,
right?
And so you've got a little note in there of, this is why I made this change. So you can at least think, or you can at least see what you were thinking at the time, even if it was erroneous. And then you can go back in time, right? You can look at all the changes that were made, and you know, the variations of, this is what it looks like now, this is what it looked like then. Let me compare the two. So you can do diffs on different stuff too. So it's really cool to be able to just have that much control over what's going on. So not only can you kind of document as you go and why things were changed, but you can also go back in time and see what happened. I think that's killer. I mean, and when you look at it from like a software development perspective, it's like, I don't know how you would functionally do this stuff in Teams without some kind of tool like this. But I think if you look at it from like a regular network engineer's perspective, it's pretty cool in that aspect too. I mean, and it's not everything, not everything on GitHub is public. Not everybody can see everything, right? You can have private hidden repos that are just your personal internal stuff. So,
and now GitHub has three private organizations and teams, so you can create as many teams as you want and have as many private repositories as you want on their free tier, which is kind of cool. They're moving more into charging for how many minutes you use to do the automation and builds. So now you can make a GitHub account and you can make different organizations and separate your code. If you've got different businesses or projects, they can live in their own little namespace, so it's not thrown all in your account, and it's completely free now, which is pretty nice.
It's interesting. So it sounds like they're trying to push out some of the CI/CD tools that other people would use, just to, or is it not necessarily push out, but just make it so enticing to use their stuff? You just,
convenient, yeah.
Because now I don't have to maintain all these other things. I can just use this one thing, and it does everything I require. Because I guess Jenkins is open source and agnostic, right? So it can pull and push from all these things and set up pipelines to, and I know there's lots of plugins for Jenkins too. So you can have it like do your code testing through this thing, and then have your, you know, your syntax checking or your formatting rather over on this other plugin. So I guess it's a little bit more extendable. I guess that's why you would use that. I'm not sure what Red Hat uses. I think they probably use a little Jenkins here and there. I think I've heard them talk about it. So,
yeah, there's a lot of good systems out there, but at least with the source control systems, there's so many more users for those than individual CI/CD platforms, that by, you know, putting it into the platform, you already have this whole user base of people that can contribute. So there's all kinds of cool stuff. Like if your application has specific dependencies that it downloads, like when you build your app, part of the workflow, people have made open source contributions where it can automatically cache all that stuff between builds. So if you make a new build, it doesn't have to pull in all that stuff into a fresh container. So there's like all this like caching and stuff built in that make your, every time you run those CI/CD pipelines, they're faster after the first run. So there's like all these convenience things that people are kind of baking into it, that you just have to configure a YAML file and put it in your repo, and like GitHub goes, oh, okay, you got this stuff I need to do, so I'm going to make these workflows and I'll send you an alert or whatever.
That's cool.
So I think that the ease of use and flexibility, you know, you configure one file and now you have all this fancy stuff going. And there's people, you know, in certain languages that have like these pre-built full pipelines that you can take, paste it in, and now it's ready to go. So it's easy to get started. And I think that's what they're focusing on, is ease of use.
That's cool. That's cool. I guess, I mean, that's the idea, especially if it's somebody's new to that world. If you're just going to bundle it all together, have easy to use examples, why wouldn't they just stick with your product? It makes sense.
Right.
Make it too easy not to use it.
Yeah, because everybody wants better code, better systems. So.
Oh, yeah.
Got to give people better tools so they know, you know, something breaks, they know to troubleshoot it instead of, you know, sweating because they pushed it out to production and now something's broken and they don't know what's broken. Which nobody ever does, right?
No, I would never. You know, I mean, it goes back to the same old saying. It's like everybody's got a test network. Not everybody's got a production one as well. Yeah.
Right. True.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'm sure it's the same thing for a lot of applications and developers.
Yeah.
Oh, man, that's wild. That's wild. Oh, so tell me about this new puppy you got. What's this animal's name?
Her name is Mishka.
Mishka?
Yeah.
What's that about?
Yeah, she's pretty big.
What is it, like a Malamute or something?
Yep, she's an Alaskan Malamute, and it's I think it means little bear, and she is kind of a little bear. She's outside right now. Yeah, she's a little puppy, but she's like 55 pounds. She's pretty big. She's only like 6 months old or so.
Oh my god. You've
Yeah, she's big.
What's this thing going to be like when it's full grown? Is it like 100 pounds or something?
Maybe. She was the runt of the litter, so I think her dad was like 160 pounds. My mom was like 110 pounds.
Are you kidding me?
So she's going to be pretty big.
I guess
yeah.
If times get lean, you can not always kidding. Eat it. There's that.
No. I shouldn't get lean. The stores have toilet paper again, and all is good.
All is good. Yeah, I was thinking about my dog. We've got two little Westies. One is like 12 pounds, the other one's like 13. They're small dogs. But they, you know, they're little tanks. They think they're 160 pounds. But it was funny, like my littlest dog Tink, she like, I don't know, she was eating her butt the other day. She was just like gnawing away on her butt. She was just so vigorous about it that as soon as she got done, she had to like catch her breath.
Calm down.
It's like, oh man, this is some hard work. She's, I'm gonna need a break, guys. I'm gonna give me 15. I'll be right back.
Take a nap, have a cigarette.
Yeah, it's hilarious. Those things are ridiculous. As you know, so
yeah, she's
go ahead.
Well, so she's a Malamute. So they look very similar to Huskies, but they have really like broad chests because they're working dogs. They're meant to like pull weight. And so when my wife takes her for a walk, she's already, you know, 50-some pounds. And so once she, like, squares up and gets her paws, like, solid, she'll just pull her around the yard. She can't, like, stop her. It's so funny. She like, barrels up and puts her head forward, and she'll just pull her.
That's like nothing. Recipe
so
for
I'm going to have to walk her soon.
And Mary's not very big. Is she pretty small?
No, she's pretty small.
Oh, man.
So she has a really hard time, especially when she's energetic.
She doesn't stand
she'll
a chance.
She'll just pull her. Yeah, I'm going to look out the window, and she's going to be sliding across the grass at some point.
Just hook a
so
plow
I'm going to have to
dog.
Do the walking eventually.
Yeah, it sounds like. Hopefully right? You don't have any squirrels around. You're toast, buddy.
Oh, we do.
It's over.
We do.
Lord have mercy. So we were thinking about things we could do this summer with the kids. Mm. And my wife was talking about, yeah, I don't know where this idea. She said, you know, drive-through safaris are open. Have you ever done one of those?
No.
You've never done a drive-through safari? Well, it spawned this distinct memory of the last time we went is I can't remember. It was in Glen Rose, which is like near Waco here. And so you get in your car, and sometimes they give you like food or whatever, and you drive, and then you can like roll down your windows in certain areas, not all areas. You know, and then there'll just be wild animals around you, and you just kind of, you like follow along the path or whatever. But it reminded me how ostriches are basically devil spawn. You know, they were made in the Dark Lord's own image. Those things are evil. Have you ever looked an ostrich in the eye? It's one of those things. It's like you don't stare in the darkness for too long, or you become part of it. Man, they are mean and basically terrifying. Yeah, it's like you know, it's like I don't really fear anything, but I am I am kind of afraid of ostriches. I'm pretty sure that that they run on pure hate and evil. It's a strange experience because they always like immediately try and shove their head into your car and just like steal anything they possibly can. They're the worst.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, and they're really fast.
Yeah, it reminds me of I think it's called a cassowary. Have you ever heard of that?
That sounds familiar.
It's another type of bird that's similar to an ostrich.
We have emus around here that just look like mini ostriches.
Now, these things, it reminded me of those because they're very fast. They can keep up with, like, a vehicle. And apparently they have really sharp claws, like they've sliced the side of a car door.
Oh, bro.
Something, and they're often labeled as the world's most dangerous bird. So I don't trust birds.
I don't know, man. I bet chicken with salmonella kills more humans than a cassowary. So
it could. Maybe, probably could.
Maybe they are the most deadly bird. Just gotta look at it in the right light.
As long as you're in the car, though, you're safe.
So you think. I've seen Jurassic Park too many times to know that they'll just rip the roof right off. And then they kill the lawyer on the toilet right next to you.
Oh, it's no good.
All right, man. Well, what's new and different? What closing thoughts do you have for people? What wisdom would you like to impart? We haven't talked in so long. I assume you've got a good nugget for me. What is it?
I don't know. I feel like I've said a lot.
For sure, man. Well,
good nugget.
Well, let's leave it with this. If folks want to get a hold of you out on the internet, how do they do that?
I'm kind of playing around with a website. It's ario.cloud. There's a contact form on there.
That's much easier than them trying to guess right. How to spell arowana.
That's why I'm doing that. ario.cloud.
I like that. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
You do network consulting. You do network monitoring install. You do, what is it? What is it that, give me the quick rundown. What are the things that you can help folks with?
Well, that's partially why right now I don't have a lot of stuff on the website yet because I don't know what I want to focus on. But generally it's been, networking more heavily leaning towards MikroTik networks, network monitoring systems. So I host the monitor for a couple people's networks. I don't want to host it themselves. But yeah, generally that's more of the focus. So
rock and roll. All right.
Yeah.
If folks want to get a hold of me, it's greg@gregsoul.com, just like always. I can't say that I very occasionally blog. I blog regularly again now because I'm having to learn so much stuff, which means I have to put blog posts up so that I can remember how to do things a week from now. Dude, it's like I'm shoving stuff in so fast, it's just flying through like a sieve on the other side. So I'm trying to maintain as much as I possibly can. You can also.
I'm starting to.
Go ahead.
Possibly blog too, because for that same problem.
he is mortal. He does have
human. I gotta write stuff down.
Oh no! Oh no! You're getting old. You're gonna be yelling at people to get off your lawn in no time. Although that would require human interaction, and I'm not sure you're up for that. So.
That would probably be good for me, actually.
Yeah, there you go.
Yelling at people.
Be a good cathartic process. Let's see, but you can find both of us on the Brothers Wisp Slack. That's patreon.com/thebrotherswisp. You throw us a couple bones, we send you access to the Slack. And we're still having communication wars between that matters most and what's the other one? Discord. I guess nobody's really set on it. I just don't have time for anything anymore. So I just, I've been making myself go through the Slack regularly. So I have actually gotten caught up and I am trying to stay engaged in that. So having said that, I'm doing training all next week. Oh yeah. And I did my own workshop for the very first time
awesome.
This week. So that was good. So I am a real human boy now.
real human boy.
Yeah. I'm a man now. I've had my bar mitzvah, so it's good. So I feel useful now, and so next week is going to be slam jammed. And I've not only am I doing training all week, like 9 to 5, but I'm also covering a workshop and then some other stuff. So there's going to be some gaps in there. So it's going to be fun. It's going to be a good week. But I guess if you guys have any questions, comments, get a hold of Nick. He's the smartest kid I know. And thanks for joining, Nick. Appreciate catching up with you. I never get to see you anymore. You shun me for your monstrous dog and your wife, so I understand.
No, no shunning.
Oh, the shame of it all. All right, man. Thanks, and we'll talk to you guys soon.
Lighting up the towers so people can start searching. Shooting up the web in neighborhoods, net surfing. We got horrible jokes, we're loud and annoying. But we're informative facts, we're not disappointing. Just give us a listen, cause fun is the mission. I'm telling you, you don't know what you are missing. Ideas and some good comedy given. If you missed the show already, don't worry, you're forgiven.